Welcome everybody to the Melbourne Press Club. I'm Mark Baker, the Chief Executive. It's a great pleasure to see so many of you here today, but also so many new faces to a Melbourne Press Club event. In particular, of course, I'd like to warmly welcome our guest of honour, Professor Alan Fells, who is no stranger to any of us, and indeed no stranger to the Melbourne Press Club. He's a long-standing member of the club, a regular attendee at events such as this, and of course, early in the year we had an excellent panel event looking at the fallout from the Hayne Royal Commission, and Alan was an active and significant participant in that panel. So. But of course today he has the stage more or less to himself with a little bit of supervision from our esteemed president, Adele Ferguson. So welcome to you both. Of course the context in which we're meeting today is the release of Alan's new book, Tough Customer. Now we love the cover of this book, and people say of course that you can't judge a book by its cover, but I think we can judge this one by this cover. This is a photograph taken by Ray Strange of News Corp some years ago. If you can see it, we have the courageous battler for consumer rights about to give, I presume, the oil companies both Bowsers, one pump in each hand. And of course, this was a serious threat in those days because back then there was lead in petrol, no longer, but great book. So we will hear a lot more about this very shortly. So as I say, welcome everyone. In particular, I'd like to welcome and acknowledge the Melbourne Press Club sponsors, without whom we couldn't do what we do. In particular, our principal sponsors, Monash University, represented today by Associate Professor Johan Lidberg, and Virgin Australia Airlines, our co-principal sponsor. And to our premium sponsors, Minter Ellison Lawyers, David Poulton, right on cue. Welcome, David. The Commonwealth Bank and our host today, Crown Resorts. I'd also like to acknowledge our major media sponsors and our major sponsors, all of whom you will see featuring on the electronic board. A number of other people that I'd like to particularly acknowledge today. I don't think she's... Sandra Parker, the Fair Work Ombudsman, Nathan Hollier, the publisher from Melbourne University Publishing, and David Kemp, former Federal Cabinet Minister. Welcome to you all. On your tables you'll find flyers for a few things happening and coming up. Of course, their next event at the club will be quite soon. On Tuesday of next week we have a lunch event with Annabel Crabb, which is selling very fast, but we still have a few seats available. So if you're interested, I suggest call us or get onto our website and make a booking, if not today, then tomorrow for that one. You'll also see some flyers for a couple of quite important programs that we're running at the moment with a particular focus on journalism. We're very proud to be hosting for a second year the Michael Gordon Fellowships, which is a program under which we are provide grants up to a total of $30,000 each year for journalists to undertake projects in the area of social justice journalism. And we had a very successful launch of that last year, and the program is underway. Applications will close on Thursday of next week. So if you're a journalist, have a look at that. If you know others who might like to apply, please encourage them to do so. And of course, that program was established and honours the memory of our esteemed colleague Michael Gordon, who died earlier last year. And finally, you'll see some flyers too for our China Journalism Exchange Program, which is we've had an association over some years with the Asia Pacific Journalism Centre in Melbourne. Now we're formally collaborating with them this year to take a group of eight Australian journalists into China for a 10-day tour, which will have a particular focus on environmental issues and the climate crisis, which will be an important one. So once again, welcome everybody. I'll be back a little bit later after we've had our main course to get things underway with our panel. So please enjoy your meal and thank you. Before I invite Adele and Alan Fells up to the stage, We have a little interlude. Each year, the Melbourne Press Club awards two prizes of which we're particularly proud. One is the Young Journalist of the Year Award, which we award in conjunction with our annual Krill Awards each March, and our Student Journalist of the Year Award. And for the best part of a decade now, we've sent the prize for that, the Young Journalist of the Year Award, is that we send the winning journalist to attend the Investigative Editors and Reporters and Editors Conference in the United States, which is the bee's knees event for investigative journalism in the United States, and a wonderful opportunity for young journalists to be exposed to some of the best operators in the profession. And for the last 3 years, we've also sent our Student Journalist of the Year winner to that conference. And after the conference, which is in June, this year it was in Houston, we invite the journalists to come and share briefly some of their experiences with us at an event such as today. So today I'm pleased to welcome Matilda Morozzi from the ABC, who was our Young Journalist of the Year Award winner for 2018. Please welcome her.
Thanks for having me. It's an honour to be here with Alan Fells and Adele Ferguson, who are two people whose work I really admire. I'm sure you're familiar with their work, but you may not be as familiar with mine. In 2018, I did a series of stories on underpayment in the hospitality industry, the first of which was on Shannon Bennett's restaurant, Rue du Monde, which is one of the most exclusive restaurants in Melbourne, but wasn't paying their staff minimum wages, and followed with a series of stories on places including Northcote's Barry Cafe and Birch and Purchase, and then The Age started doing some stories on venues like Rockpool. And by May, the Andrews State Labor Government had announced that they'll be criminalising wage theft in their term. So potentially employers who are intentionally underpaying their workers because they end up going to jail. And it was... thanks. It was awesome doing that work and seeing what had happened and seeing workers get back paid. And the cherry on top was to find out in March that I was awarded the Young Journalist of the Year and had the opportunity to go to this conference in the US. I was joined by Peter Bateman, who is a Young Student Journalist of the Year from Monash. He's in Thailand working at the UN, so isn't here today to talk about his experiences, but I can vouch for it that he had a good time and learnt a lot. I'll tell you a little bit about the conference. It was in Houston this year, incredibly hot, humid, and I was pretty jet-lagged when I got there. Went for 3.5 days. This year's conference was actually the biggest they'd ever had. There was almost 2,000 investigative reporters, editors, and journalism students there who were interested in investigations. And across the weekend, there was 175 panels, workshops and classes that were offered for people to attend. To focus on diversity as well, 60% of the speakers there were women and 30% were journalists of colour. Huge breadth of topics were covered in these panels, some of which were about finding, cultivating and protecting sources, how to find and frame investigations, backgrounding, preparing for confrontational interviews, and also a lot of talk about how to deal with data, how to find data, how to get stories out of data and then include that and present that in your reporting. There was, as I said, 175 panels. I definitely didn't go to all of them, but I thought I'd share some highlights. Towards the end of the conference, they had an awards luncheon where they put out awards for some of the best reporting across the world and also the Golden Padlock for the most secretive organisation, which this year was awarded to Michigan University, who'd kept a lot of information secret in terms of sexual assault that had occurred on campus with some of their teachers there. The keynote speaker this year was Rick Hutzel. He's the editor of the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland. And most of you wouldn't have heard of Rick if it wasn't for the shooting that occurred in his newsroom in June 2018. And a gunman walked into the local newsroom there for a local paper and killed five of his reporters. That was almost half of his staff. He happened to be on holiday that week, and from his keynote speech, it seems like he still feels a lot of guilt for the fact that he wasn't there for the newsroom in such a traumatic time. His speech was really emotional and heartfelt and moving, and through the trauma, what shone through was his belief in local journalism and how important that is for the community. And he said afterwards, what was important for him is that they kept putting out the paper. And journalists from around the country, reporters who had been there years ago, came and volunteered their time to help put out the paper to make sure that the local community still had their news, despite the fact that this horrific event had happened. The community also rallied around them, and he said he realised from the community's reaction how important this paper actually was for the people living there. And listening to him, it was a reminder of how important local news is and just the magnitude of what we've been losing in the past decade or more, with all these local papers shutting down and regional television bulletins no longer going to air in Victoria. The showcase panel this year was called Investigating Trump World, and involved some of the biggest names of reporters around the US who've done stories on Trump, including Andrea Bernstein from New York Public Radio, Suzanne Craig from the New York Times, David Fahrenholt from the Washington Post, and there was a couple of others as well. They discussed their biggest investigations, how they did them, the importance of documents and data, as well as trusted sources in how to cover this president who is almost unprecedented in how to deal with him in the White House, and the number of, well, there was a debate about whether you call them lies or false news or whatever you want to call them, but how to work with that. There was also some kind of funner sessions. A charismatic journalist called Al Tompkins from Pointer he presented these Al's cool tools for investigators, and he had mostly free, because you know journalists don't have a lot of money, but tools that you could use to either do your investigative reporting or to help present it. This included Batch Geo, which allowed you to make great map graphics from spreadsheets in seconds. There was interview transcription tools, and also the ability to make out 3D images with some software, or how to find out where photos were taken so that you can verify that what you're reporting is true. When I arrived in June, it was shortly after Annika Smethurst was raided and the AFP raided offices of the ABC in Sydney. And so, particularly talking to people in my work sometimes where they don't want their identity revealed, and knowing that the AFP could potentially get a warrant and come and look at your emails and change them even, I was interested in finding out more about digital security, and they had a fair bit on that as well. The Electronic Frontier Foundation has put together a free online surveillance self-defense course, and if anyone's dealing with sensitive sources and doesn't know about that, I'd recommend educating yourself. But sadly, at the end of the session, I figured if, even with the best digital hygiene, it's difficult to completely cover your tracks and protect sources, but it's definitely important to try and minimize the chance of that, and something that I'm doing at the moment and will continue to do as technology changes and you need to keep up. It was definitely a privilege to have the time to dedicate to my professional development. By far the most valuable thing was just meeting all of the people there and to be surrounded by hundreds of investigative journalists who are really passionate about what they do, who care about what they do, and to share their craft and their passion was amazing. It also gave me perspective. At the conference hotel, of course, in Houston, there was like a Texas-shaped pool on the front that you could walk around, and I was there and I met a journalist from Russia. His name's Roman Anin. He's done a lot of stories exposing organized crime and corruption in Russia, and I talked to him and I was like, isn't it risky working as a journalist there? And he kind of shrugged it off and he's like, yeah, you know, it's risky. And he said six of his colleagues had been killed doing their work, but said it wasn't so bad because more journalists were killed in Mexico or something. And it's a real wake-up call for me, because while we don't have the constitutional right to freedom of speech that a lot of journalists did there from the US, I don't feel like my life is at risk for just doing my job. anyone wants more information about the conference, some of the sessions that were happening, or access to the tip sheets that I got, feel free to get in touch with me either here or I'm on Twitter at Morozzi_M. It was an amazing opportunity, and thanks again to the Press Club for sending me and Peter there. And I'm thrilled that I got the opportunity to go there and hope that it improves my work as an investigative journalist as I progress through my career. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much, Matilda, and congratulations. I'd now like to invite Alan Fells and Adele Ferguson.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Professor Alan Fells doesn't really need an introduction. The former head of the competition watchdog, the ACCC, Alan became a household name fighting for customer rights. He hit the headlines big time when he was sacked at the age of 74 by convenience store giant 7-Eleven, fighting for underpaid worker rights. The point is, since he began his career, he's never been far from the headlines. And today, he's probably one of the best well-known public figures that we have. He's wined and dined with politicians, record industry heads, media moguls, academics, and even the Chinese Communist Party officials. And at 77, he hasn't slowed down, as his latest book, Tough Customer, Chasing a Better Deal for Customers, shows. He's a professorial fellow at Melbourne University, a visiting professor at Oxford University. He's been on a number of inquiries, including the Royal Commission into Mental Health. Professor Fells would like to spend the first 5 minutes or so talking about why he decided to write this latest book and why he decided to begin it in 2003 after he retired from the ACCC. And he wants to outline some of the common themes that recur time and time again, despite the various industries he's straddled, including mental health, the taxi industry, executive pay, competition, and wage underpayment. After that, we'll move into conversation, and then we'll open it up for questions from the floor. So with this brief introduction, Alan Fells.
So thanks very much, Adele. It's a pleasure to be here. As to needing no introduction, I believe Henry Kissinger was recently introduced as needing no introduction, and he complained bitterly he wanted a long introduction, but anyway, you did well enough for me. So just why did I write this book? Well, I wanted to tell stories of some interesting things that I've done since leaving the ACCC in 2003. Actually, there is a book about me at the ACCC. From my point of view, it had one big problem. It was written by someone else, and he insisted on listing all the mistakes and errors I made in this book. So this time, you won't hear of any mistakes or errors whatsoever. I kind of have wanted to say that what I've learnt since then is that life is not just about promoting competitive markets. There are some other things in life as well. And so that's certainly the case with regard to mental illness. I've told that story, the story of Isabella, who's here today. To give people a bit of an idea of the personal impact on the person with mental illness and on their families and carers and friends, and then to go on and talk about policy questions broad social and political questions that arise about doing something about mental health, which I faced when I was chair of the National Mental Health Commission. However, I wanted to get back to kind of business-related things, and I guess the story started, as Adele mentioned, with the 7-Eleven exposure, which she led. She did the chief exposure and writing about it, including a Four Corners program. And 7-Eleven asked me to make up the lost pay of the underpaid workers. And very interestingly, $165 million has been repaid by 7-Eleven voluntarily. And I learnt something from that. The fines under the Act are quite small compared to that. And also, it's really difficult if you go through the full legal process, court hearings and all that, to get that kind of money for repayment. But when a firm decides to do it voluntarily, you get big results. So maybe there's some lessons from that for law enforcement. So then, and then government asked me to do a whole inquiry into it. Actually, when 7-Eleven sacked me, there's a lot of publicity, and that night I got a call both from Malcolm Turnbull as Prime Minister and Bill Shorten. Bill was in a Canberra restaurant and he asked me for a concise account. Now, I assume concise meant 50 minutes. So apparently he had been writing some notes on a tablecloth, and he was filling up the tablecloth, and eventually they cleared all the dishes and he was still writing. And then at the end of it, his assistant, who I ran into, had to spend the next day trying to transcribe this huge tablecloth that he was carrying around. But anyway, I was appointed to run an inquiry, and we came up with the finding that the Commonwealth, we've already heard about today, the Commonwealth should criminalise wage theft in certain cases, and to my pleasure, the Coalition has supported that. I was involved in the Productivity Commission inquiry into executive pay. Was it excessive? And so that's where the so-called two strikes rule came out, and I may comment on that maybe. And also I had a few things to do with commenting on the Hayne Royal Commission. And I can't stop myself in this book from getting back to a competition question. So taxis, in the end, their license fees, their drivers and so on, but in the end, the answer is that industry needed a dose of competition. So that was what my rather long report on that was all about. And I've said a few other things, particularly the competition law's fine, but they need a power to break up business. That's one of my important conclusions. And then finally, education. Education's always important. For 10 years after I left the ACCC, I ran the Australia and New Zealand School of Government, which trains high-up public servants. I've said a bit about that. And then, somewhat unbelievably, the Chinese Communist Party asked me to do a training program for them. And so I've been training them with slightly mixed results, you may think, for the last 10 years. They come to Australia to find out how we deal with poverty and environment and stuff like that. And in return, we do a visit which they host in China. I could talk about that. So what are the common themes in this book? It's a bit hard to put all these things together, but I always ask three questions. What can you do that would be of value to the public? What's the public interest in this? What should be done? That comes up all the time. Secondly, in government, another tricky question. you can't just decide these things. It depends on the political surroundings, what I call the authorising environment. What does it say you should do and how do you deal with it? And thirdly, even if there's something good you should do and there's support from the political environment, can you do it? What are the actual practical issues? So that's kind of how I frame all of this work. And I've also had a few reflections on whether I believe or not some kind of market type solutions. So that's my introductory remarks. Adele, over to you, back to you. Thanks.
Alan, you've been described as a media tart by business commentator Terry McCran, which prompted you to call a media conference to deny it.
Yes.
Paul Keating famously referred to you as a media nymphomaniac. Is it true?
Yes, unashamedly. And it's a really important thing. Of course, educating the public and business, the media helps a great deal in that, but it's also makes you powerful. It makes you effective and influential. It means you can get out there and defend your point of view and attack whoever there is. It makes business really worried about you. They're worried about things you might say to them in public. So your bargaining power is very great. And likewise, politicians are worried or impressed, if you like, by your access to the media. So both of those people, business and politicians, are a bit more careful about pushing you around and obstructing you. And the media, I've found, is generally supportive of a regulator serving the public interest. Where the regulator doesn't do the job, the media will tend to attack them. But it's not just kind of running a PR campaign. There has to be something to back it up. So if you just call a media conference and say, I'm going to do something, the media will lose interest. It's the fact that you are actually doing things that they can report on that makes the difference. It's really two components of getting publicity, if you like. One is do something, do it in the public interest, and then publicise it to have maximum effect.
So is it... How important is naming and shaming a company? Is this one of the powers that you can have as a regulator or as a commentator?
It's a tremendously powerful weapon. The ACCC, it could get fines and so on in court, occasionally damages. More recently, criminal, jail sentences. But time and time again, the really big thing was the reputation issue. And I can tell that because if you're doing an agreement with business, maybe that they'd agree in court to a certain level of fine and so on, they always pushed hard on publicity. And I never gave ground on that. But as you have pointed out, with other regulators, particularly ASIC, they've got into practices of agreeing their media releases with the defending party, and they have bargained to soften media releases. But that just confirms to me how important is the naming and shaming. It has a big effect on corporate behaviour. I sometimes used to say, during the GST time, the Howard government was extremely keen on the ACCC having a role in stopping excessive price rises, and they gave us a bit of money to spend on radio ads. But We got free ads every night on television and media newspapers just through news. That was worth hundreds of millions of dollars of advertising. Or to put it another way, supposing a firm on the receiving end wanted to run a counter program or response through advertising, they would have had to spend tens and tens of millions in advertising to have the same impact.
Right. Well, I think we've learned a lot about how Alan Fells has used the media over the many decades. One of your chapters is about 7-Eleven and your involvement there, which was a case of, you know, the biggest convenience store giant, massive franchise that was rampantly, systematically ripping off vulnerable workers. You were sacked. You mention in the book and just now that Malcolm Turnbull rang you. What did he say?
He said, what to do. So I happen to have three things ready. It was partly I had been grilled by none other than you on Four Corners, and I had to have some answers then. The first one was to strengthen the power and resources of the Fair Work Ombudsman, who's here today with Sandra Parker. The second was to investigate the thing, set up a whole inquiry into underpay in thousands and thousands and thousands of temporary migrant workers. There are several hundred thousand who are underpaid. But thirdly, that they should change the law. It wasn't just a matter of fining these little franchisees running these little shops. That wasn't viable. What they should do is make the franchisor, the 7-Elevens of the world, liable legally if there was underpay by the shops. If the franchisor should have known about it or did know about it and could have done something about it and did neither of those things, then there should be. And that went through. The coalition pushed it through. Actually, I've got one little story about it, which was mentioned in the book, that the opposition from the franchise industry was really strong, and it was conducted by the former outgoing cabinet minister, Bruce Bilson, who is a really good talker, lobbyist. He knew everyone in Parliament, got all over Parliament House trying to stop it. And then there's this life-saving moment that the 7:30 report caught him out on something embarrassing.
Double-dipping.
Yeah. He, while he was still a member of Parliament, in that short interval before the election, after he'd been a minister, he became chairman of the Franchise Industry Council and was taking pay. He'd been paid whilst he was a member of Parliament by a lobby group. And that took all the wind out of his sails and just killed off his principled opposition to the change. And it went through, and the law's now in effect.
So you went on the migrant task force workforce, and you came across, it wasn't just 7-Eleven, it's rampant throughout Australia. Are we doing enough? And is, you know, you're saying the government has adopted your recommendations, but is it happening fast enough, and is it enough?
They really need to get on with it now, particularly the criminalisation of wage theft. Before the election, the coalition considered my proposal that wage theft is just as serious as consumer theft. The law and the penalties should be put on the same basis as consumer and competition law. And in particular, in serious cases, there should be the possibility of a jail sentence, as there is in consumer and competition law. So they announced that before the election, and then more recently, both the Prime Minister and the Attorney General, Christian Porter, have said they're working on the bill. Personally, I'm prepared to give them a few months in office with all the other things on the agenda but now is the time to bring forward this law.
And I guess at the end of the day, it's what the bill looks like. If it is diluted and little happens, what are the implications for the economy?
Well, it's right to talk about the economy level, because once it was maybe just a small number of people who were being underpaid. But there's enough data to say that there are several hundred thousand people currently being seriously underpaid. I don't mean there's a bit of a mistake in calculating their rates. I mean half paid or less, or other forms of exploitation. That is so big. It is such a large part of the workforce, it is having a macro effect. I think I saw the Grattan Institute saying that's one of the several reasons why wage growth is slow. We've got hundreds of thousands of people out there, migrant workers, temporary migrant workers, being seriously underpaid. Now, it's true they do some jobs that said Australians won't do, but when it's that big, it has an effect on the labour market. Not a good effect.
Thank you. You dedicate a chapter of the book to reforming the taxi industry. It was very controversial, and it ultimately paved the way for the rise of Uber, which you're now associated with. What was the problem with taxis, and are you satisfied that it's fixed now?
Well, broadly, it's fixed. There are a few details still to talk about. The problem was, well, there's this whole question of framing a problem, which I talk about in the book. But in the case of taxis, I actually did four official reports in 84, 92, no, 3, and 2001, and the Productivity Commission did one, which had no effect, because we framed it as there are these undesirable licensing restrictions and they should be removed. And that sounds just like some funny economics thing. So when I got around doing the fourth report, which was a big one, the problem was framed correctly as very poor service to the public, low quality of service, dirty cars, drivers who didn't know their way around. There was this story about someone wanted to get to the airport and the driver didn't know the way, so the passenger got in the driver's seat and drove him to the airport. The whole quality of service was poor. The fact is the industry captured regulation and they went way over the top in using it to their benefit and the harm of the public. So in that setting, it was possible to bring in a competition solution. And also, my report was kind of a compromise about what we do about license values. Effectively, I halved them overnight, and it went through the Napthine Liberal Coalition cabinet by 12 votes to 11. And so that broke the back of the industry. They suddenly realised they were no longer invulnerable, and then a bit later, Uber came along and cleaned them up.
So Uber's an interesting one, because in the book you say the rise of Uber affected your view of regulation. And this is what you say: Uber would not have got off the ground if it had gone to the regulators seeking permission to operate. This would have been denied. You then say you believe business should comply with regulation, but in Uber's case, the only way to launch the service was to disregard the law, trusting customer support. So how do you reconcile your belief in the rule of law, your years and years as a regulator, with your view about Uber? And does it suggest that the way we regulate needs to change?
Yes, well, I just can't reconcile them, really. I mean, the only way for Uber was to do what it did. And, of course, it does tell you that you've got to have some really good mechanisms for changing regulation. The only trouble is a lot of people tried and didn't succeed. I do think sometimes the way economists set up and frame problems, it doesn't capture the public. And certainly in my report, we tried to emphasise things that were of popular and public appeal rather than economic appeal. But it is... Now, I'd also just like to...
But it is a curly one, isn't it?
It is
How do you... You know, they were breaking the law.
Yeah. So anyway, now, I have got a extremely... I have got this slightly pathetic defence, but I'm going to make it. I'm going to be held down for this. The legal thing is that the taxi commission, after I left... wanted to sue Uber, but Uber was not doing anything illegal. It was the drivers. So they had to take on the drivers and they fined them on a civil basis. Uber paid the fines, the thing went on. So the taxi commission got smart and they ran a criminal case against the drivers. And then there was a massive battle and it turned out that Uber and the drivers were not doing anything illegal because the Taxi Act was framed in the 30s and it was ridiculous. What it said was that we're going to regulate taxis. Taxis are cars with domes on the top. So if you ran a taxi service and didn't have a dome on top, the Supreme Court of Victoria ruled that you're doing nothing illegal. So Uber was not breaking the law.
Okay.
Now, of course, I'm on the Uber advisory.
Yeah.
Anyway. But it is a real... it was a real lesson there about... And Uber, of course, they got the service going and that built massive public support, which changed the whole politics of it.
Absolutely. I know that sometimes I quote you in underpayment of wages and I'll get emails from people saying, what about Uber not paying taxes, underpaying drivers, etc. How do you answer criticism about Uber?
Look, on the taxes, first of all, I don't give a damn about Uber, really. I'm very happy to occasionally go to San Francisco and take part in their deliberations, but I'm not on the board, I'm on the advisory board. But on the tax, this is my impression. As far as their Australian earnings are going, they are properly taxed by the tax commissioner. But they still make a big profit and they send that overseas. Now, the profit overseas is not taxed. It goes to the Netherlands. And in the Netherlands, there's this famous thing called the double Dutch law. So if you set up a corporation in the Netherlands, they will not impose any tax whatsoever, providing you set up another business in the Bahamas or somewhere. So the big tax avoidance is offshore. The European Union is slowly getting around to eliminating that tax dodge. In the US, it is my impression Uber pays its proper taxes there, but again, it shifts a lot of profits after that to the Netherlands.
Okay,
now so that's my version of it.
We're running out of time,
yes,
Alan,
sorry.
So we'll keep the next few questions, the answers brief.
Sorry.
So that the audience can get a chance.
I've got to catch a plane on
Saturday. Okay. Yes, yeah, so we'll move on to executive pay. You did the two strikes. And in your book, you talk about the gap between executive pay and pay of the rest of the community is unacceptable. And you say the best approach to remedy the situation is tightening tax laws and their loopholes for those at the top. Can you briefly elaborate what you're proposing?
Well, I am proposing briefly that in annual reports, the pay ratio of the chief executive and the average worker should be published, and also there should be a binding shareholder vote on remuneration. On tax, there's on high taxes, there's a lot of loopholes. They should be closed. Trusts, capital gains should be strengthened. And I've always thought there's quite a lot to be said for an inheritance tax.
And you talk in the book about the Royal Commission into financial services, and you're concerned that the amounts of money are too great, that the banks are likely to go back to their bad ways. Why do you think this, and what did Hayne miss?
Well, Hayne's answer was tougher regulation, which we may get a bit of, and change in bank culture. It's already obvious just reading the papers and looking around. The financial services lobby is perhaps the most powerful and effective in Australia. It's fought off reform over many years. I think it will probably do the same over the next two or three years, and I can already see it having an effect.
Thank you. And the most importantly, and it was the first chapter in your book, is on mental health. It's been one of your greatest passions over many decades, and it's been driven by personal experience. Can you tell us, just open up a bit about your personal experience with Isabella, who, as you said, is here, and what that taught you, and what you think we need to do in the mental health industry? Because if you read this chapter, it is really sobering when you look at the statistics and the funding and the impact on the economy and human beings.
Isabella had a very difficult childhood, not because of her parents, in my opinion, but she had kind of a genetic-based mental health problem. At 25, she had a full-blown psychotic attack, and that psychotic attack that confirmed she had serious, persistent schizophrenia. It has a huge effect on her life, makes it quite difficult. There's some side effects, obsessive compulsive disorder, etc. Now, I and my late wife worked really hard to find appropriate treatment, which is accommodation, especially stable accommodation, care and support, which we do through the Haven Foundation. There are now seven funded entities which provide that sort of accommodation each time for about 15 or 20 people living independently but together. At the level of the policy, so Isabella is very well looked after compared to most people with severe mental illness. The data is that there are 700,000 Australians with severe persistent mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar, etc. Another 2.5 million with really quite serious mental health problems, deep depression, anxiety, personality disorders, all sorts of things. And unfortunately, this has been a really low political priority. It's always the low man, the low person on the totem pole. And even when it briefly gets to the top, it's just there for a little time, and then other things are treated as more important. So we've got to give it higher priority. Same time, the system is not well organised. It's got a whole lot of holes in it, and in particular, there's the missing middle. In other words, if you go to a GP or a psychologist, that's not too bad. It's not that great. It's not too bad. At the other end, if you have to head to hospital, that's fairly well organised, although I'm hearing terrible stories at the moment about hospitals. The average time a person with serious psychotic mental illness spends in a hospital has been nearly halved in the last 5 years, not because of better treatment, because lack of funds and massive pressure. Even so, that's organised. Now, all the stuff in the middle, that's really weak, giving them accommodation, psychosocial support and so on. It's a huge challenge.
So you're on the Royal Commission. Has it shocked you?
It has. I was chairman of the National Mental Health Commission. I heard a lot of sad stories there. It was a little bit national Commonwealth level stuff. But the Royal Commission has been effective and it's been very well reported in the media. We've heard incredible number of harrowing stories, and also we've got better investigation powers. And it turns out there's a lot of powerful, shocking data about the inadequate treatment of people with mental illness at all levels of the system.
We could keep talking about mental health because it is such a hugely important topic, but I think we'll open it up to the floor. So, any questions?
Bill Birnbauer, Professor Fells, you talked about the concept of authorisation. Seems to me the opposite has actually been happening in journalism. Where do we get some of that? For the media.
Where
do we get that authorisation that leads to political reform, social reform, credibility and so forth? How does journalism achieve authorisation in terms of not only policymakers but the general public?
I'll give you an unwelcome reply. You're on your own. I fear. The ACCC report has suggested that some things be done. It's identified the adverse effect of digital platforms on the business model, and it's recommended more funding, mainly for local and country journalism, and that's welcome. It doesn't really get to the core of the problem, the declining power and impact of the major media. And it obviously blinked at the thought that there should be support for them, including through making your subscription to a newspaper tax deductible. They thought about it and they couldn't quite bring themselves to do that. So I fear the honest answer is governments are not going to fix it for you.
Is that over here, Meg?
Am I next door, I think?
Yes.
So following on from your comments there, Professor Fells, if you were still chair of the ACCC, what would you do about the digital platforms?
Well, first of all, I'd be worried about how good my economic grasp of the digital platforms, with all sorts of new economic questions about two-sided markets, network effects, economies of scale and scope, etc. So I could either go the American way, which is stand back and study the problem for the next 10 years and work out the answer 10 years too late, or I could go the European, especially German way, plunge in, find them, do all sorts of things without being quite sure whether that's the right thing to do. In terms of the way people think about it, there are three schools of thought. One is antitrust, doing a good job. Another is competition laws on the right track, but it just needs far more vigorous enforcement within the paradigm. And there's a new school of thought, popularly called hipster economics, which says actually all that competition stuff has got it wrong and it ignores the realities of power. I'm probably in the middle camp, just activate more strongly. With Google and Facebook, I'll be surprised if there's not some litigation soon, which will be interesting and important, but some of you here would regard it as details, not getting to the core.
Okay, and over to Philip.
Thank you, Alan. Still Sweeney here. We met at Melbourne University a few months ago. My question follows on comments made by Adele, which is just like the fallout from the Royal Commission, and also relates to competition in the superannuation industry. Now, you were quoted in the media this week about having concerns that the big banks would relapse after the Hale Royal Commission. But you also note there are some important developments happening in the financial services area, and especially the growing scale of superannuation funds, which will soon be many times larger than some of the banks. And then the question is, well, will they acquire banks? Will they gradually establish their own banking business? Where will the banks be in 20 years? Now, of course, the industry funds have already started in that track, and they've set up a members' equity bank and are likely to establish more banks in the future. Now, Peter Costello, who is the chairman of the Future Fund and also, I think, the chairman of the employer of Adele, has come up with a proposal to open up the Future Fund, which was set up to for pay the superannuation of Commonwealth public servants, open it up to the general public to be a competitor to the industry funds, because basically the super funds run by the banks are on the nose now. So my I'd be interested to see your thoughts on whether you think the Morrison government would be actually taking a step of actually having to semi-nationalise the superannuation industry as a counter to the growing strength and dominance of the industry funds, which are obviously aligned with the Labor Party and the union movement. Any comments on that, or do you see another competition solution?
In the book, I just mentioned that despite all the fuss about ethics of banks and all of that, there are two huge changes confronting banks. One is the rise of super funds, probably could buy the banks if they wanted to pretty soon. I don't know that they'll be direct competitors, they haven't got the infrastructure, but they're becoming very important shareholders and could own a few. Secondly, the other big thing coming is big tech, Apple and Google, and I've seen it in China. They're Tencent and the other telco companies are just taking over the financial services industry. Will it happen here, and what about fintech? Now, on your question, this the idea that maybe with the power of the industry funds, the declining power of retail funds, maybe we need to get the Future Fund competing. I think that ought to be looked at. I don't want to quite endorse it. I think there may be a Productivity Commission inquiry on superannuation coming up, according to the Morrison government, I read, and they ought to look at it. There are quite a few tricky issues. I mean, the Future Fund was set up for a purpose and it's got an investment plan, may not quite suit the needs of the default people whose super goes in there. Quite a big question. Another thing, just putting my narrow competition hat on, we don't like, and by the way, coalition government, even Labor, not terribly keen on government business competing with the private sector if they have an artificial advantage as a result of being government-owned. And that would happen in this case. I mean, I'd feel almost it's unfair competition. You can just put your money with a government super fund, with the government. Why take the risk on an industry fund? So that's called the issue of competitive neutrality. I'm sure if it goes to the Productivity Commission, I'll have a look at that.
Okay, thank you. I think that's all the questions. One question here. Yes? One last question.
Thanks, Adele. David Poulton. Thanks, Alan. Just on that subject of ethics and morality, we've had a culture in this country of corporations essentially existing for their shareholders, and that's come under scrutiny recently in areas like the same-sex marriage debate and companies taking a part in that, and more recently indirectly in requiring companies or organisations which they sponsor to behave in a certain way as regards their employees, as we've seen with the Folau case. Where do you see the role for morality and community activism and those sorts of matters in for corporations? Should they stay out of it? Is that something we should encourage? Will that be something that would improve, if you like, corporate behaviour?
Corporates have a responsibility to act lawfully and ethically. That's basic. But should they have other responsibilities, like you're getting at? I think there are some difficult questions. Who decides these things? Do they decide? Do the billionaires decide, as we keep hearing from the World Economic Forum? The accountability for CSR is pretty interesting question. I see one of the industry funds said they should spend a lot more money on climate change. How do I feel about this as a shareholder? So it's a tricky question when you get into it. Also, I think my bigger wish is that we maximise competition and hope that gets some good results for the community.
Okay, thank you. One last question with a one-sentence answer. What's your greatest achievement?
Well, I met the Beckhams. I met Posh flying economy from Sydney, from Canberra to Sydney. She'd been talking to John Howard. Her baby got ill. They threw her on this plane. When she told me who she was, I didn't believe it. Then we got off and these teenagers started following her, not me, her. And then we got to the baggage and this fellow came up and she said, oh, this is my husband. And I said, oh, hello, what's your name? And she said, David, he's a footballer. And I kind of looked down my nose a bit, footballer. And I said, would you mind, you know, when you're getting your wife, you pick up my brown bag and bring it back. I'll keep talking to your charming wife. And it was them. I saw her on telly a few weeks after.
Professor Fells, thank you. It is a great book, and he's agreed to sign down the end. So please buy a copy of the book. It's a great read. Thanks, everyone, for coming.